Talk given Saturday, 25th October, 1975. Most of us here think of the self according to the way in which we have been conditioned to interpret the word oneself, or to interpret the word I, or the word me, and so forth. Practically every one of us here has been born into a culture which has postulated a body, a mind, a soul, a spirit. This part is perishable, that part is immortal, and so on. Those of us who have become deeply interested and concerned with the teachings of the Buddha, as presented in the texts, talk in terms of no self. And yet, we all behave exactly as if we were selves in the same sense as all other people in the world talk about and behave with regard to their own selves. There is this Buddhist teaching of anatta, which so many have translated as no self, there is no self. And if you ask what they mean, they say, there is no abiding entity, no permanent unchanging entity as far as the body, the feelings, the thoughts, the conceptions, the volitions, and consciousness itself are concerned. Supposing we put it this way, anatta is the negation of atta. But the negation cannot be postulated apart from the opposite of the negation. So the concept, the idea, the feeling, if you like, of that which is permanent, immeasurable, that which was never born, never ages, never dies, is implicit in the negation of that idea. Therefore, if we put it this way, that the atta, that which is the absolute, the eternal, or use any word you like, that which is the absolute, is devoid of all its temporary forms and shapes. Our actual experience is that here is a body, here is a mind, a person who experiences feelings, thoughts, and so forth. And it is with reference to this bundle of form, feelings, thoughts, and so on, that that particular person refers to himself as I, to all other similar bundles as you, or the other person. If a phenomenon does take place at all, does it not necessarily imply an origin of the phenomenon? The origin could, of course, be another phenomenon. But is that to suggest that the non-existence of a phenomenon, the reality of the absolute, a noumenon, can be denied? That which is the ultimate origin as such is the thing one cannot speak about. One cannot conceive of it, cannot imagine it, cannot define it. Because if we could define it, there'd be no distinction at all between the infinite and the immeasurable, from the finite and the measurable, from the deathless. No difference between the deathless and that which comes into being and perishes. So, instead of approaching it exclusively from the point of view of the fact of anatta, that means that the manifestation has no abiding separate entity in it, regard the absolute as that which is devoid of temporal, finite, particular, changing forms which come into being and perish. It's void of those things. If you look at it that way, you will find that so much talk about the void which goes on in these somewhat rarefied intellectual atmospheres is nonsense talk. And there is only something which is quite real about it all. And that real, the Buddha himself, that which is not void, he himself declares, and you'll find it in the Majjhima Nikaya, in two of the discourses particularly, are the six sense fields conditioned by life and grounded on this very body itself. You can realize voidness with respect to everything else, but you cannot realize voidness with respect to this living body. So now, the word self is a somewhat unfortunate term in relation to the Sanskrit word atma, the Pali word atta. The Pali word atta is definitely used throughout the texts to signify the person himself, this very body. So let's just bear that in mind. Because if we do, we shall be free of the difficulties that arise in our own minds in terms of declaring that the Buddhist teaching flatly contradicts all other teachings. It is the obverse expression, the reverse expression of the other teachings. And both expressions are wholly valid if properly understood. The flaw is with our shortness of understanding. Because do remember, the presentation of truth, the presentation of reality, can be so varied that it requires a very circumspect intelligence, which can really look round everywhere to see the relationships between what otherwise seem to be irreconcilable opposites. Now, let us just turn again to this word oneself. We know we associate it in the ordinary way with the living body. We talk of my body, my feelings, my thoughts. Just how accurate is that? The my part of it. This body, whilst it is alive, has to eat and drink. It takes in matter from the outside world into itself. There is a process of transformation chemically. Parts of those of that chemical substance is integrated into the tissues, into the body structure, and part is rejected. When I eat something, then an apple, which I say is not me, to start with, does it become me once it's inside? And if through the transformation process, whatever matter is rejected, is it me or I who have this become me or I? What do I mean by my body? You see, I mean, this is quite obvious to anybody, is it not? It's quite obvious that this is the case. Why do I bring it up? Because although we may see this logically, intellectually, we don't really understand it. Because if we really knew this as the fact, what would be the consequence? Or at least some of the important consequences. Would there be personal vanity, for instance? Vanity which is born of the body. Would there be the pursuit of so many pleasures which inevitably involve the body? Eating, drinking, talking, to start with. Would there be this senseless, thoughtless indulgence in such things? Or would we regard food and drink as necessities which have to be intelligently dealt with in order that this living body may continue to live and function to the highest possible advantage for life, not for me? Because if I think in exclusive terms and do not think in terms of life in its wholeness, then I will inevitably make mistakes, go wrong, and be in conflict with my neighbor, with my environment, with my circumstances, and all the rest of it. I shall make trouble in the house because my bananas were not available for my dinner that night. All that nonsense would be out, wouldn't it? So much meaningless pampering of the body, the passionate pursuit of good health, strength, all that would be out, wouldn't it? And how excellent that would be. Because consider, what does your strong, healthy man do with his body in the days of his strength? doesn't he squander the greater part of his energy? Doesn't he use it for the egoistic expression of his own vanity and self-conceit in the world? Consider carefully just exactly how men and women actually behave throughout their lives. So, when I say my body, I'm in thrall, I'm a slave of all these things. But if I realize, truly realize, that this body is not my body, but it is part of something bigger than itself, then I shall be free from so many ill things in life, things which dehumanize me and which spoil life, not only for myself, but for all others around me. Possessiveness and associated with it acquisitiveness, avarice, and when one cannot acquire, one is envious of those who have, one is jealous of the other person, and so on and so on. All that would disappear with the disappearance of this misconcept, my body. So you see, the word self is a bit of a poisonous snake in the grass, isn't it? That's dealing with the body alone. What about my feelings and my thoughts, my character, my chances, my opportunities, my rights, my privileges? You know, one has really to see this, feel it with total intensity, which means a wholly quiet, poised intellect at the same time. Otherwise, you are just, you'll start wallowing in emotion and resentment against circumstances, against life, against other people, and all the rest of it. See it completely. If I am free of my rights, my privileges, I shall never be anti-social. I shall begin to be social only when I am freed of this miserable misfortune involved in the word my and mine. Because when my and mine are out, in what manner am I conscious of existence? I am conscious in terms of the wholeness of everything. I'm conscious in terms not just of you and you and you associated with me. We all belong to the same party, we are good party members and all the rest of the humbug, you see. But we'll have a real sense of sociability, of socialness, all humanity, when I am freed of this selfness embodied in the word, this exclusive, excluding selfness embodied in the word my and and the word mine. Then the social feeling, the social sense, has at last begun to operate quite naturally and quite simply. Until then, the use of these words, social, socialism, and all the rest of it, are just shibboleths, just different, a new kind of instrument of harm, destruction, wielded by ignorant, egoistic, power-lusting people. Before this word came into prominence, other words were used. Liberty, fraternity, equality. And the whole thing is a heap of nonsense. An evil nonsense, harmful nonsense, bringing us, ourselves, pain, illness, misery. It's the same with my thoughts, my ideas, my ideals. I've just mentioned liberty, fraternity, equality. What marvelous results came about through flaunting those words, particularly at the end of the 1780s. Now, what do people understand by liberty? I can do what I like. Can I? And if I can't, and if I'm prevented, just what do? I prevent everybody else around me from doing what he likes. And therefore, this wonderful liberty lands us into a terrible prison. Fraternity. Have you ever seen any two youngsters indulging in fisticuffs more furiously than two brothers? All in the name of fraternity. Fraternity? What is at the back of my mind when I say to you, brother, my brother? Supposing you were the brother of that fellow who is my enemy, what do I say to you? You must answer for yourself. So, my thoughts, my ideas and ideals and all the rest of it are again void of the reality involved in the word humanity or human being. We say, I know this, that, or the other. What do I mean by saying I know? Do I really know? All that has happened is, usually, I have acquired a certain conceptual and verbal pattern. I remember that conceptual and verbal pattern, and I remember certain forms of expression in terms of physical action and behavioral action which represent those conceptual and verbal forms. And I say, oh yes, I know this. And what happens when somebody else comes along and firmly upholds his knowledge, which contradicts my knowledge? Is it knowledge when you get two contradictory conceptions, which cannot be related to each other, which cannot be reconciled with each other? Either one or the other is right. And if this one is right, then that one is false. You see, we have rarely to go deeply into this in our own minds. And we'll soon see that we'll discover that the one thing that perhaps we may speak of in terms of I know, is to say that I do not know. What we can legitimately say is that at present it seems to me that such and such is true or is the case. But be completely open-minded. You can hold with firmness the statement, it seems that this is the case at the moment. Yes, you can hold that with firmness until fresh evidence comes along to modify that statement or even to contradict it, in which case you can just let it go. So you see, this business of saying I know represents in practically all cases merely the clinging to a conditioned state of mind. All beliefs, convictions, conceptions, ideas and so on, they are conditioned states of mind. Now, as long as we live, from moment to moment, the state of our mind is a conditioned state, true enough. But the trouble comes when we cling to that particular conditioned state, that particular form, and say, no, this must remain with me forever. This is the eternal truth, or this is the voice of God himself speaking through Jack Jones or whoever he may be. We say that and we cling to it. But now consider what happens. Can the mind ever live, grow, or become mature if we do that? What is one of the outstanding features of that which is living? Continuous process of transformation, is it not? Here is this living body, as we say. Roughly, there are 15 billion cells. I'm talking of the old English billion. 15 million, million cells composing this body. Now, supposing I say, I've got my 15 billion cells. Let them remain exactly as they are. What would happen? You'd all be coming to my funeral before long. Because if they are going to stay put like that, the life process would stop. There'd be no growth, there'd be no change, there'd be no transformation. This is wooing oneself as if oneself was a corpse, making love to a corpse. That is all we do. Now, apply this to the mind. If our thoughts, our feelings, our ideas, our conceptions are not allowed to change in the right way, at the right time, in the right manner, then that mind is going to become corpse-like. Isn't this true? I mean, seriously and sadly true of all humanity today. Isn't that one of the reasons that humanity, mankind today, is just precipitately rushing into a state of utter violence, confusion, murder, utter inhumanity? Think how successfully in these last 5 or 6 years particularly, the human race has shown devilishness all along the line. And why? Because it clings to my will, my ideas, my desires. We want a separate community here, a separate economy, and a separate government here from there. We want those people out and these people in, and so forth and so forth. And that will, that congealed thought, that corpse of a thought, is like a vampire. A ghoul, is that the correct pronunciation? It's like a ghoul living upon, eating up living human beings. And isn't that just precisely what is happening in the world today? With its horror and its evil? Why? Because the mind of man is utterly diseased. It is ill at ease. And it has become, man has become delirious. And in his wild delirium, he doesn't know what evil he is doing. Hence the violence, the murder, the utter absence of a moral backbone or anything like that. These people know, of course. They all claim to know. The French Revolution people claimed to know what was best. The communists did the same. The Nazis did the same. Everybody has done the same. The conservatives, the socialists, the liberals, the Tom, Dick and Harry's, the whole lot, they all know. For 4 million years, mankind didn't know until Tom, Dick and Harry came on the scene. What extraordinary conceit and stupidity. Do you wonder that the Buddha, as the third source of all evil, put his finger upon delusion? Another translation of the Pali word is confusion of the mind, the complete absence of clarity. And that means that the mind is cluttered up with all these misconceptions and false ideas. It is not emptied of these corpses, this decaying rubbish in the mind. If it is empty of all that, then the mind becomes transparent. And the light of reality, the light of transcendence itself shines through, and at last man lives naturally, spontaneously, happily as man. This is the point. You know how easily people say, oh, I couldn't possibly give up these ideas. This is my faith, my firm faith, and I shall be loyal and true to it. Yes, all right. Be loyal to corpses and see what happens. Be loyal to death. And with death is associated sin, sorrow, and all evil. This death, which is disruption, not death as we have often talked of it, the perfecter and the consummator, the liberator into, out of finitude into infinitude, out of mortality into immortality. That's the real meaning of death. But this other meaning is the thing which actually prevails with us. So you see, myself. If you start with myself, what on earth do I mean by myself? You will find yourself before long embarking on a course which is characterized by utter denudation. A denudation, becoming stripped of everything. Becoming stripped of everything that we hold possessively and limitedly. Stripped of every fixation. And therefore also associated with of complexes, neuroses, psychoses, and the whole lot of that rubbish. Because you or I, the living organism, live not by our grasping out at death, but by the power, this mysterious power of life, which is so pure and beautiful and wonderful, irresistible. We live by that, and that is the one thing we do not know, because we want to put it into concepts and words. I've often said you can't measure the Atlantic with your teacup. How shall you or I measure the infinite, possess the infinite, by means of our mortal finitude? You see how different becomes the meaning of a word like freedom when you realize this. Freedom consists in letting the life process work, and then the birth-death pulse, the life, other life pulse of creation, works unhindered through you, not only through your consciousness, but each and every one of your mind states, your feeling states, and your very body itself. The body becomes transfigured. Where do you think energy comes from? You grow old, and you feel the burden of age. But if and when your intelligence is alight and you are totally attending, then suddenly you are all energy. There's a tremendous output of power. Not my power, but power in its infinity. It just flows through you because you don't keep back anything for yourself. And this is the meaning of being at home with death. Let go from moment to moment that which is passing. Don't hold back anything. Be totally attentive to everything and anything as it emerges, and be as completely attentive simultaneously to that same thing as it passes away. And there you've got the creative pulse of existence itself. And then you will discover that myself is the one and only self, the totality. If you don't hold on to anything, and anything and everything enters you and moves out of you, this great rhythm of life, you see, then what can the self be but the one and only totality? We talk of the body as being material and perishable, of the soul. We postulate a soul or a spirit as eternal, an eternal entity. We never postulate it as the eternal totality, because then we lose the self-sense, the separate self-sense, altogether, don't we? But this body is matter, as we commonly call it, out of the total matter of the universe. I talked about eating, and what we eat is transformed in our in the body, and so on. All right. All that is matter. But is that the only interplay of matter? There is matter throughout the universe, as we call it. And soul or spirit or anything like that is another word to express this mysterious, unknown, and in certain aspects unknowable energy, which is responsible for that type of interaction with a living body, by virtue of which feelings, thoughts, our whole mental process a whole process of development, of entering what we call the deep states of consciousness, of realizing the Unio Mystica, and everything else happens. So it's all a play of energy. One and only energy. And that one and only energy is the absolutely indefinable. We can only know the different forms of expression of energy. We can only know energy at best at its secondary stage. Take science itself with what it knows. It doesn't know what energy as pure energy means. It only knows energy in the different forms of its manifestation. Electricity, magnetism, heat, light, mechanical energy, chemical energy, and so on. It knows it in all these forms, which are at best the secondary stage, not the primary energy itself. Now, what is the astonishing thing about this manifestation of energy at our ordinary human level, which people have forgotten and not looked at? We know all these manifestations only by virtue of the fact that there has to be a material, a solid material apparatus for their manifestation. Can you throw a ball of electricity pure and simple at me? Can't. But put two different metals into little dilute acid and connect them with a wire, and then we immediately observe that an electric current flows. Where was that electricity? You can't catch it. The word electricity, the phenomenon electricity, comes into being simply because there are solid metals, there is a liquid acid, and so on, present. And lo and behold, this mysterious thing called energy manifests. Take magnetism. You have a magnetized bar of iron, we'll say, to start with. We don't know precisely what it means. We can perform certain experiments and say, now this is due to the magnetism in the bar magnet, and we can magnetize little pieces of steel with it and so forth and say, there it is. But in every case, minus the material physical object, we cannot deal with that energy or know anything about that energy. So you see where we are coming to. We take physical objects themselves. And today, it is common knowledge at last, after all these tens of thousands of years that we've lived on the globe, it is common knowledge at last that what we call matter and energy are interconvertible. Put it this way, matter is energy concretized. Energy is matter which is utterly etherealized. It is because we are constituted as we are, and are conscious of existence in the way in which we are conscious, that we form concepts, we perform experiments, and then talk in this manner. Now, if we realize that also, then you will begin to see why I constantly keep saying, the one thing I know is that I don't know. Supposing I were a neutrino, how would I know the universe? I'd just be going through you like without let or hindrance. I'd be going roaming through the universe without any obstruction whatsoever in my path. That is to say, there are what you and I would call obstructions, solid obstructions, but they don't mean a thing to me. I just go right through them like that. And what's more, I as a neutrino have no mass. No mass. This is a nice massive thing, this body, isn't it? Can you and I imagine, picture ourselves without mass, but possessed of this being this extraordinary energy which just goes through everything without let or hindrance? How, in what manner would I know the universe? Can you imagine Jack Neutrino talking to Mary Neutrino saying, do you know what I discovered today? And she answers, oh yes, I know all about that. And you see how important it is that we should sort of awaken in inner awareness. This is of fundamental importance. If we awaken in inner awareness of whatsoever comes within the field of our everyday experience, then we shall naturally become free of all the clutter of conceptions which are mostly misconceptions of truth, of fact, of reality. And just try and visualize. This is a really valuable exercise for you. Try and visualize what our daily life would be like, what our daily conduct in body, in speech, and in thought and feeling would be like. The change that would take place. This awakening in inner consciousness, I'll repeat that phrase again and again, is quite different from the working of the brain as the senses operate. When you are at home alone by yourself, that is the best time. You say, I know all the furniture in my room. That's that chair, and there's my table, and there's my piano or guitar or whatever it is, and so forth. Now, just look at that object. And let the mind become free of the statement, that is a guitar. You just practice this and see what happens. Let the mind try and become free of all that is implied in that is a guitar, or that is my chair, or writing desk, or whatever, or book, or whatever it is. Let the mind become free, but remain totally alert, attentive. Not expecting something, not wanting anything to happen. This is important. Just be attentive. So attentive that your subconscious awareness that I am attending to that chair is completely out. This is supreme meditation. Because as long as there is this subconscious background, I, the separate person, am attending to that chair, the separate object. When those pictures are out, a new dimension of reality, a totally new dimension of being and consciousness, suddenly flashes into being. And something happens which is totally indescribable. All these all the limitations due to our concepts, our memory, all our ideas and so forth, all the limitations disappear and something utterly new comes about. And you will not know it analytically with the brain. You will see it and not see it simultaneously. See, we've often read about this, you have often heard me speak about this, this life-death pulse is a simultaneity of life-death. Now, how on earth can that take place? You see, we can't conceive of it, can we? We are so conditioned in our sense of time and space is so fixed, so determined, and so determining that simultaneity of two apparently different things in the same place and time is inconceivable. You just can't form a picture of it. And yet, something like that takes place. Why do you think we have this extraordinary sentence, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be? You know, I have a few times in past meetings presented this way, that if you can, in imagination, let your mind encompass the whole earth, what do you discover? That any one moment, this moment here, where we are now in space and time, at this moment, but if you go right round the earth, there are 24 hours involved, aren't there? The time is different. There are 24 hours involved right round the earth, and all the things that you and I do in the course of our ordinary 24 hours moving this way is happening now. Expand that to the whole solar system, to the galaxy, to the entire cosmos. As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be. Not statically, but as an extraordinary transformative and transmutative activity, a creative activity. If you become aware of this, if you get a real flash of it, you will see why I constantly say that the old pictures presented of rebirth in time and space and the karmic process, causality and determinism and action and reaction and cause and effect and all the rest of it, they are all inadequate concepts. I don't say that they do not represent some wonderful inmost reality, but the forms in which that has been expressed through the centuries is a misleading form. Become free of it. Here now, the totality. And if you awaken in your inner consciousness to this life-death pulse, this life-other-life pulsation, which is the creativeness of the creative power, which is the whole of the universe, in action, then suddenly everything transforms, everything changes. And you yourself are the full and complete human. Then, when you are conscious, when you are aware in that manner. So that, as I said a little earlier, you will both see and not see the chair. You will see totality in the finite thing. You will know the chair as chair, see the chair as chair, and simultaneously completely transcend all the limitations of seeing the chair as chair. Don't believe this. It is beliefs which spoil truth, besmirch truth, and make truth the untruth. Why have nations fought horrible wars and perpetrated incredible cruelties upon each other in the name of religious truth? They have misused the word truth in the name of untruth, which they tied sacrilegiously to the word religion. You see, we start here with ourselves, and we awake in inner consciousness to this self-same John Brown as the totality, as that which is eternal, perfect, wonderful, but in its wonder includes everything that terrifies us also, that feels painful to us. But be completely open to it. And if the mind is totally open, totally vulnerable, then you will not know sorrow.